This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Jared Yates Sexton is a writer who rose to prominence for his coverage of the Trump campaign and its rallies in the lead-up to the 2016 election. Even after that race, his interest in the culture surrounding Donald Trump continued. In his new book, Jared incorporates the political and the personal. He intertwines his own family story with an analysis of the hyper-masculinity he attributes to Trump and other men. The book is called The Man They Wanted Me to Be, Toxic Masculinity and a Crisis of Our Own Making. Jared Yates Sexton is an associate professor of creative writing at Georgia Southern University, and he joins me now. Welcome back, Jared.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
What do you mean when you say toxic masculinity?
Well, it's a really long conversation, but it boils down to when men are insecure or they don't feel secure in their manhood, they oftentimes overcompensate for that insecurity. So what you'll see are these overperformance of the idea of masculinity. They'll become violent, they'll become aggressive, they'll intimidate, they'll abuse. And so it's a set of behaviors that comes from the inability to live up to the idea of masculinity.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I just saw that Meryl Streep said we should stop using the phrase toxic masculinity. So you have to stop now because Meryl Streep said so. But that's not the point. I think the way she understood that, and this is why I asked you to define it, was that from her critique, it seemed to me that she thought we were saying toxicity and masculinity are identical. But you're saying, no, it's masculinity that has become toxic, and it's for these reasons. What did it look like in those Trump rallies that you attended?
Well, especially in those rallies, it was a really unsettling experience to be in those rallies. You would see a lot of men who would be gathered around each other, and they would sort of compete to see who could push the line the farthest. And that was through misogynistic comments, through racist comments. And you would see one man say something, and then another man next to him sort of take it a little bit further until eventually it turns into these calls to kill people, to assault people. And that's one of the things that we see with the Trump movement is it is a competition of hypermasculinity, and these men who are holding on to these old, outdated, dangerous concepts, and they're encouraging one another to behave in these ways.
Well, and not even holding on to, but distorted into caricature their ideas of manhood that never were manhood, but that it seems to me that get distorted out of fear and some insecurity that something that you had is leaving.
Exactly. And there are so many instances in history where insecure masculine populations overcompensate. And this is one of the reasons why we see genocides. We see the rise of fascism is people who feel insecure about their masculinity are way more susceptible to these appeals to overcompensate and join groups and to thus feel more manly. It's a really dangerous situation.
Why is it dangerous?
Well, because it basically tells men that because they are at the top of the food chain and because the patriarchy that they belong to is a way of looking at the world, the people who disagree with them are either irrational or they're not really human. And so that can lead to situations where women in vulnerable populations are basically endangered by men who want to prove that they are masculine and powerful, and they'll do a lot of terrible things to prove that.
We're talking about this in a very broad scope, but you decided to write this book from a deeply personal perspective based on your own upbringing in rural Indiana. What kind of messages did you get as a kid about being a man from your home?
Well, the men in my family were laborers. They were mine workers, factory workers. They belonged to that old traditional sense of masculinity. And one of the things that happened with me was I always felt uncomfortable with the expectations. I was a creative kid. I talked to everyone. I was very intellectually curious. And so as a result, I was on the receiving end of a lot of physical, verbal, and emotional abuse. And I found that that is actually one of the ways that masculinity is transmitted, is that we are told that you're not supposed to be emotional, even though all boys are emotional. And so they are subjected to abuse until they harden up or until they give up those things. So weirdly enough, I felt like an outsider, but that's actually how all men feel when they're being conditioned.
Well, tell us in particular about your dad and the impact he had on you and sort of how you got these messages.
Sure. My father was a baby boomer. He was in the Marine Corps for a while. He actually never went to Vietnam, but he, you know, he talked about himself like he was this hardened veteran. He was the kind of person who'd watch Patton on a Saturday afternoon and talk about, you know, how things used to be. But what actually ended up happening was I later on talked to him, and he confided in me after years and years of racist and fascist behavior that he had been stifled by masculinity. He had felt alone. He had felt insecure, and he had not had intellectual or emotional interactions with people for so long simply because he had to play a role. And what I learned through him and my experiences with him is that this is a role that men have to play. And even while they're playing it, they know that it's ill-fitting and it's not who they are.
But of course, because not expressing yourself emotionally or even verbally or in any way is part of the performance, you don't even tell somebody this, right? You're living with it and you can't express it.
That's right. Unfortunately, men become unwitting jailers of each other. There are a lot of studies out right now that show that men are inherently lonely and their friendships don't have a lot of intimacy. And so you'll have two men who will hang out and watch sports and they'll talk about something like sports, but they'll never talk about how they're feeling or where their emotions are or this ill-fitting idea of masculinity. And as a result, they try and show each other that they perform and they end up reinforcing it in each other. So it's a really terrible cycle.
And it's one that begins, you know, many generations earlier. You talked, too, about your grandfather, his experience in World War II and his unwillingness for a long time to talk about it.
That's right. My grandfather was a war hero who received a Purple Heart in the European theater, and he came back to America, and he had a really hard time processing what he had went through. And like a lot of men who are unable to talk about it, he relied on substance abuse. He became an alcoholic. Eventually, later on, though, he was this really emotional man. He was the emotional caretaker in my family. He was actually able to express himself because he had proven himself in the field of battle. So that was actually one of the ways that I was able to receive positive reinforcement in terms of empathy and emotion. And some people just aren't lucky enough to have those role models.
It did take him a while, though, to confide in you about the reality of that war experience, one that we tend to glorify from the outside. And he wanted to, at some point, disabuse you of that.
That's right. He watched me, and this was in the 1980s, he watched me do things like watch G.I. Joe and watch these movies that portrayed our armed services as unflinching and warriors who were never afraid. And I think now, especially with the anniversary of D-Day, it's important to remember that these are people who were terribly afraid, but they went ahead and did their duty. And I think that's a really important thing that we need to hold on to, that it's okay to be a man and be afraid and to have these misgivings, but to go ahead and do these things when you can. And I think when we start to put together those disparate ideas of manhood, we start to see a real picture of who people are.
It's had a real impact on your father. He became estranged from the family, and for a long time, you two hardly talked at all, right?
Yeah, we actually didn't have much to do with each other for the first 29, 30 years of my life. And the problem there was he always felt uncomfortable around me. I wanted to talk. I wanted to have conversations. And again, he wanted the tried and true masculine thing of standing around in a garage and not saying anything. So we actually butted heads a lot of the times, but we eventually found each other.
Well, you did, and it's interesting because it was your dad who reached out and when he made a run for mayor, of all things. Tell us more about this.
Yeah, so when I was around 20 years old, my dad decided that he was going to run for mayor of my small Indiana town, and he really didn't have a chance of winning at all, and we got beat very badly, but he asked me to be his political campaign manager. So the reason why our relationship had a resurgence was because he needed something. It was about utility, and so we made this run for the mayorship of my small hometown, and through that time we got to know each other and trust each other, and that was the reason why we were able to start communicating about who we were and how masculinity had affected us.
Talking to Jared Yates Sexton about his book, The Man They Wanted Me to Be, Toxic Masculinity and a Crisis of Our Own Making. Your dad ultimately diagnosed with diabetes, which had gone unchecked and untreated for years, right? And you say this is another real symptom of toxic masculinity.
Absolutely. It's really, really tragic. My father, like many other men, wasn't able to muster the courage to go to the doctor. He died at the way too young age of 59 after suffering with a diabetes that could have been treated, and his death certainly could have been prevented. But when we look at how men treat the doctor, we start to see the contradictions of masculinity. men are terribly afraid of going to the doctor. They don't want to be told bad news. They don't want to find out something bad, which flies completely in the face of our idea of men being unflinching and courageous. And what actually happens is they live shorter, more miserable lives because they could get all of these chronic illnesses checked out and they could get treated. And so as a result, their families have to live years and years without them and have to deal with the pain of losing a family member simply because men are too afraid to go to the doctor.
Well, let's talk about some of these transitions that had to happen along the way. Your father did ultimately reach out to you and see a doctor. You did work with him on that campaign. What were the changes that you were seeing, or did you see changes taking place in him over this time that led up to his run for mayor and reaching out to you? And how did working on his campaign affect you?
Well, it's very odd to look at it now, especially in a time of political polarization where everyone says that nobody can change and everybody is so steadfast in what they believe. My father, around the time of the Iraq War, was vehemently pro-war. He was the type of person who would buy the biggest pickup truck you could find. He didn't care about environmental issues. He lived that life and he performed that role. But after we got to know each other and he started to talk to me and work these things out, he traded in his pickup truck for a Prius. He became the person who, when he hung out with his buddies and talked about things, he was the one talking about climate change. And what actually happened, and I've learned this through research, is that men perform the role even in their political and social beliefs. So anytime that you want to talk about something like climate change or you want to talk about rights for other people or social safety nets, men who actually know that maybe these are good ideas or things that need to be taken care of will actually go ahead and go against it because they don't want to be perceived as soft or feminine. For myself, the interaction with my dad, I was very glad to be there for him, but I actually found myself starting to behave in the way that he had in the past. Even though I was uncomfortable with masculine expectations, I started to perform them. I started going down a self-destructive path of toxic masculinity simply because my dad started to want something to do with me, which was an unfortunate circumstance.
Well, what were those symptoms? What did you see in yourself?
Well, these are the types of things that men do in order to perform these roles. I was drinking too much. I was, you know, abusing drugs. I was, you know, really hurting myself in a lot of different circumstances. I ended up with a terrible eating disorder, which actually is something that men have all the time, but don't even believe that men can have that. It all changed for me, though. I eventually got pulled over when I was in graduate school for drunken driving. And it was like one of those moments where, like my father before me, I was performing this role and believing I was like this tough guy, devil may care character, but I was putting my life in danger and I was putting other people's lives in danger. And that was sort of the wake-up call that made me realize that this was a really bad path.
You know, it all makes sense once you operate from the premise that men are fearful of losing something and therefore exaggerate and create this caricature of manhood that never was male or masculine, but it becomes a caricature and the performance becomes critical. Everybody's got to see, I'm on board with this. I got the truck, I got the flags, I hate the environment, I'm cool. You know. So, but the question really is, where does this fear come from and how long? How far back does it go? I mean, I've seen analyses about, you know, sort of industrialization, men losing they're not out there killing the beast and drawing blood from an animal. They're actually working on these machines. Kind of anybody can do that. Oh, where's the strength in all of this? And so somewhere in the 18th, 19th century, men begin to worry about what it means to be a man. I mean, have you given any thought to sort of where these fears, how far back they go and what's at the root of all this?
Well, it goes a long way back. Some of the research I've found has found that the idea of masculinity is actually a side effect of the fact that biologically men are more susceptible to things like diseases and early death. So the idea of masculinity was a character that got made up in order to make up for that. But the idea of modern masculinity, as Americans are still holding on to, this traditional patriarchal idea, is a side effect of industrial labor. And this was back in the time where, yes, men might not have been able to make a lot of money, but they would sacrifice their bodies. And again, these are the people in my family who have to go to work in a factory or a mine and give away years of their lives simply to prove that they're willing to do it for duty. And what we see now, especially with this so-called crisis of masculinity, is the industrial age is gone and those jobs don't exist. But what we have found is they now have a political identity, which says we want those jobs. We want the coal mines back. We want the factories back. And so it's become a rousing call for them and a political identity, even though it really doesn't have a whole lot of basis in reality.
No, as you say, we're in crossroads. First of all, the factory jobs, again, were in many ways less masculine. The machine is doing the work. You're operating the machine. It's not like you're going out bringing down the deer, you know. And so that's the sort of first irony, that that's somehow masculine. But the second irony, as you point out, of the paradox is those jobs are gone. Why would we want to bring them back? So are we at a crossroads? And is this idea of toxic masculinity becoming obsolete because it simply has no application anymore in the modern workforce?
Yeah, the economy now, it rewards what we used to think of gendered female things, right? Communication, empathy, collaboration, education. These are all things that men are taught that they're not supposed to be doing. So the problem right now isn't necessarily how this goes forward, because personally as a teacher, I see in my students and in young people that they're not tied down by these things. The gender fluid idea is a lot more ingrained with them. So this might actually wear itself out. The real danger is the crisis of the people who were brought up in it and can't imagine a world that isn't like that. And so, again, that political identity is this very, very angry, aggrieved idea that the world needs to be the way that it used to be and continue to be that way. And that's where this political and social clash is coming from, is from that past generation and the future generation not agreeing on where the world should go.
Jared Yates Sexton, an associate professor of creative writing at Georgia Southern University, the author of The Man They Wanted Me to Be, Toxic Masculinity and a Crisis of Our Own Making. Jared, as always, a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You can catch Jared at Malaprop's bookstore in Asheville this Thursday at June 6th at 6 o'clock. And, of course, we've got that at our website, stateofthings.org. You can go there and sign up for our newsletter and get a daily preview of our lineup as well. The State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.